Okay, thank you for coming. Title of my talk is Present Impact of Global Climate Change, Creation's Call to Action. And trying to present this in as a part of the theme of this session, which is hearing God's voice in nature. And so my emphasis here is going to be on what is nature telling us? What is nature telling us concerning climate change and human impact on climate change? And just as to put the conclusions up front, increased global average temperatures have produced significant observable changes that we can see now in the atmosphere, in the oceans, in the biosphere. I'm not going to concern myself with issues of climate modeling or prediction of future climate change. I'm only going to look at observable changes that are documented now. What's happening now? How are human impacts impacting changing climate now? And so my challenge is, are we listening to what nature is telling us about our impact on the Earth, in particular on climate change? So just some basics. This is the global temperature trend in the upper right-hand diagram. It's reconstructed temperatures, global average temperatures for the last 2,000 years. Notice here there's what's called the medieval warm period around turn of the last millennium, which was one of the highest temperatures in modern history, in human history. As you can see, our current temperatures have far exceeded that. In fact, this is a little bit out of date. This value should now be up to 0.06. So this year, we're up all the way to the top of this diagram. On the lower left, this is just expanding just this very last part of the upper diagram, spreading it out. So you can see the change since the mid-1800s. And just for your information, last year, 2014, registered the highest global average temperatures in the instrumental record. And so for this year, we're exceeding the values from last year. So this year is going proving, if trends continue, to probably exceed last year as the warmest temperature on record since instrumental record. And the primary driver, there's many, many different climate drivers, but the primary driver to this recent increase in global average temperatures is anthropogenic, particularly CO2 and methane. And on the lower right-hand diagram, you see this diagram again for the last 1,000 years of measured CO2 values. And again, you see this deflection, inflection in this diagram in the late 1800s, which is now spiked up again. This value was underestimated. We're up to 400 parts per million right now. What's interesting is where that inflection point occurs. If you look at the date of Watt's invention of the steam engine, that was 1769. 1769 is almost precisely within a decade or so what that inflection point is. So this is the Industrial Revolution. This is methane. This is the last 2,000 years of methane concentrations. And again, the inflection point is at the same place. The inflection point for both of these excursions in values corresponds to the Industrial Revolution. So what are the sources? Well, we have all the various fossil fuels. We have coal, oil, natural gas. We have deforestation, particularly in tropical environments, tropical rainforest environments, where they're being converted from rainforest to grasslands, to pasture Methane, interesting, two of the main sources of anthropogenic methane is rice. Wetland rice is one of the primary foodstuffs for most of the world's population. The amount of land that's in wetland rice, those wetlands generate methane. And the other is livestock, which far surpass the natural population of ruminant animals. So those are two of the main sources of methane. So again, what I'm going to try to document on the time I have here is what are the presently observable impacts of climate change? And what I want to impress you with is the diverse and widespread impacts of climate change. Again, across the atmosphere, biosphere, and oceans. And a recognition that our actions, humanity's actions, our actions are having global impacts. And those global impacts are affecting the creation, they're affecting the non-human creation, and they're affecting vulnerable human populations. So, start out with sea ice content in the Arctic. 2012 had the lowest recorded summer extent of sea ice on record. And here's a diagram showing that. This shows the consistent trend. The important thing here is trends. Now, you're not looking year to year, decade to decade. You're looking at long-term trends. That's where what's important to recognize. And this is another way of showing that. This is looking through the year with Arctic ice extents. And all of the years, last 10 years, have all been below two standard deviations below the average from the of the 1980s through 2000. So the last 10 years have all been two standard deviations below the previous records. What about one thing that Arctic ice does is it doesn't affect sea level. You melt Arctic sea ice, that doesn't affect sea levels at all. What it does is it affects albedo, which is affects how reflective the surface of the Earth is. The less ice there is, the less reflective the Earth's surface is, and the more solar radiation absorbs. So it's a positive feedback mechanism that increases the warming. But melting of continental ice, glaciers and ice sheets, does impact global sea levels. This is Greenland. Again, this is the trend in mass loss of the Greenland ice sheet. Again, 2012 was the first year on record that the entire Greenland ice sheet experienced some degree of melting. That's the first time that's ever happened. Antarctic, a lot of talk about Antarctic and actually the sea ice around Antarctic is actually expanding in the last decade. But the actual mass of the ice sheet itself, of the Western Antarctic ice sheet, is decreasing. And this is, again, showing the trend in ice mass loss from Antarctica. And alpine glaciers around the world, this has been very well documented, lots of information and news in recent years on this. But globally, very dramatic recessions in alpine glaciers around the world. This is in Alaska. Alaska Peterson Glacier, comparing 1940 and 2005. And here is a diagram showing mass loss of alpine glaciers from different areas of the world, from different continents. And you can see there's only one area, which is Europe, which hasn't shown a significant mass loss. All the other areas around the world are showing significant losses of alpine glacial ice. All those things increase global sea levels, and actually the main driver of global sea level change right now is the warming itself. As the ocean water warms, it actually expands. Warm water takes up more volume than cold water. So as the oceans warm, It actually is increasing ocean volume, and that's a large portion of the current warming. But as glacier melt continues, the proportion of sea level rise from glacial melt will continue to rise. So we're dealing here with, in the last 100 plus years, of about 25 centimeters of sea level rise, and that's projected to increase. He said, well, that's not a big deal, but there are many populations in the world, in Pacific and Indian Ocean island nations, as well as places like Bangladesh, as well as other coastal areas, that are extraordinarily sensitive to very small changes in sea level. Permafrost. This is a really big concern of mine. Warming of the permafrost soils in the Arctic, both in North America and Asia, is beginning to melt the permafrost. And what you're seeing here is the temperatures of permafrost soils. Here is 0 degrees C, so once temperatures get above 0 degrees, then the permafrost is melting. One critical aspect of this is that those soils contain an incredible amount of carbon. This diagram to the upper right shows the carbon content of permafrost soils, and on the left, the extent, the aerial extent of permafrost. So it's a huge aerial extent, huge amount of carbon, and as those permafrost soils melt, that carbon is released in the form of methane. And so here you see what's going on. This is some examples of permafrost melting. It's especially severe in Siberia. One of the things that's happening with warming of Arctic environments is there are things called clathrates, or methane ices, which is an ice that is a combination of water ice and frozen methane. And these are present both within permafrost soils and in frozen lakes and in the seafloor. And as the climate's warming, those methane ices are melting and releasing methane. So what you're seeing here, these are methane bubbles frozen into the ice. And here is showing, all they did here is they broke one of those methane bubbles and had a flame available, and it explodes. So to show that these really are methane. And as this increases, the amount of methane being generated is accelerating. This just happened last year for the first time. These are methane explosions in Siberia. Methane that's from the melting methane ices under the permafrost. This methane builds up and then periodically explodes to the surface, creating these craters. And you can see the size of them. Here's some people for scale. These are huge things. And they first started forming last year, and they're accelerating. This year, they're appearing in more frequently than they did last year. So this is a brand new phenomenon in Siberia, and it's a result of the thawing of permafrost. Also, this is from a Russian oceanographic expedition in the Arctic. This is pictures of methane bubbles bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean, again, melting out these methane ices from the floor of the Arctic Ocean. As CO2 concentrations increase in the atmosphere, most of that CO2 dissolves in the ocean. The ocean is a huge reservoir of CO2. What happens as a result is as CO2 is dissolved within the oceans, it increases the ocean's acidity, or decreases the pH. One result of that is it's beginning to affect ocean plankton. These are a picture of small organisms that have planktonic organisms that have calcareous shells. As the oceans become more acidic, they have greater and greater difficulty in secreting those calcareous skeletons. So we're observing currently impacts on ocean plankton due to increased ocean acidities. Impacts on coral reefs with increased water temperatures, there's something called bleaching. Corals are very, very sensitive to water temperature. If temperatures get above a certain amount, They're stressed out, and one of the stresses is releasing symbiotic algae that they have within their tissues called zooxanthellae, and they turn white. They can survive this a couple times and recover, but if this continues to happen, it can cause death, the mortality of the coral reefs. This might be something that some of you have been able to observe, even in your backyard. Blooming times of plants have been consistently coming early and earlier in the season. We've noticed this in the Kansa Prairie in Kansas. And just some examples. These are long-term studies. I think this one is particularly compelling. Brits are really good at keeping records of this kind of thing. They've been doing it for hundreds of years. And in January 2015, this is in January, 368 plant species were documented to be in bloom in January. 50 years ago, in January, only 20 species were in bloom. There's also documented changes in migration of migratory species and alteration of migration pathways for species, anything from insects to birds. Also, movement of disease vectors, things like mosquitoes, ticks, other things are moving out of their normally constrained latitudinal ecosystems, spreading into higher latitudes. And with them bringing potential threats of new diseases into areas where they haven't previously existed. Similar to that is the pine beetle infestation, which you might have heard of. It's ravaged the West. And these have always been around. They're not invasive species. But what's happened is the winters aren't cold enough. The winter temperatures aren't sufficiently cold to kill the beetles, to kill the larvae over the winter, and so there's a higher population the next year, and this has caused infestation of pine beetles that have decimated vast areas of forest out west. And again, it's a direct consequence of warming, in this case, warming winters. Increase in extreme events. Australia has had some of its warmest or most extreme heat waves in recorded history. This was a couple years ago, where you can see this unbelievable concept. That's 48 degrees C. Talk about being, well, I don't know what it is out there, 39, 38. It's 48 degrees C for highs in parts of Australia. Drought increased drought stresses in different locations, as you're quite aware, many of you. The West, particularly California and Pacific Northwest, is in a very long-term drought at the moment. And these droughts are getting more common and more extreme and lasting for longer periods of time. Some consequences of drought, this is from California, forest fires and grassland fires and draining reservoirs. And the opposite, not only are current climate changes increasing the extent and frequency of droughts, they're also increasing the extent and intensity of flooding events and rainfall events.
5 minute time
limit. This is from England a couple years ago. So, what's the way forward? My point here is that we don't have to look to the future. We don't have to rely on climate models. We don't have to rely on climate projections to realize things are changing. Things are changing now. Observable changes are occurring and documented now across the board. Again, in oceans, atmosphere, ecosystems. Those changes are happening now, and those changes are unambiguously related to human activity. So denial is not an option, and ignoring our responsibility as Christians, I would also argue, is not an option. And I think where we need to begin is repentance, as with all consequences of sin, and I think this is a reflection of human sin, that our first response is personal and corporate repentance. And repentance means to turn, change direction. And so I think part of that changing of direction is recognizing that we need to turn and start doing something different and find ways to reduce our negative impacts on the climate. And recognition that we cannot continue the way things are, because those are having adverse effects on the natural world, the non-human creation, and it's having adverse effects on human populations. So I'm not going to give you any answers, anything, this is what you should do, but the very fact of changing mindset and repentance and changing our perspective from continuing the way things are to saying, what can we do to change the status quo, I think is the crucial step. Thanks.
A couple minutes for questions.
Yeah.
Keith, I think, of course, adaptation is going to be inevitable at this point in time. Your way forward notwithstanding.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess an adaptation question, and I hope this isn't considered trite at all, but have there been any efforts to mine the methane clathrates? We're seeing increased amounts of this being available, coming out. Is there a way to capture it and use it instead of some other carbon source that we're mining?
One is that mining would increase the amount of consumption of clathrates or methane ices, which is precisely what we don't want to do. Some expeditions involved in dredging clathrates. They're very abundant in the ocean floor. Some estimates are that there is more methane, more natural gas sequestered in methane ices globally than all the other natural gas reserves on Earth combined by like an order of magnitude. It's a huge amount there. But that's our problem. That we need to move away from carbon-based energy. It's a bridge. Carbon-based energy is a bridge to something else.
I guess part of the point is that if these things are going to melt and we're going to release gas, methane into the atmosphere, that's going to compound the problem. As they say in the oil and gas industry, flaring is better than letting the methane just go in because it's got a higher greenhouse gas.
Yeah, the thing is, though, methane has a much higher greenhouse impact than CO2. Methane has a fairly short lifetime cycle in the atmosphere because it gets oxidized pretty quickly. And what it gets oxidized to is CO2.
Right.
So by burning it, all you're doing is reducing residence time by a couple years, and you still have CO2, which is going to stick around and still be the problem. So
it's more like 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, whatever it is, yeah.
Let's give some others a chance.
Just a comment. You pointed out the correlation between the start of the steep rise in CO2 and the invention of the steam engine. You can also correlate that with sales of fossil fuels, which have got good economic records up for the past 200 and some years. You can see the correlation between that and the rise of CO2 as well.
Right. It's all, they're all connected to the Industrial Revolution, essentially.
John?
Yeah, Keith, I want to thank you for what you shared. It's excellent. And I think the basic message, besides the data, is what nature is telling us. And the end message that call for repentance and change. And it doesn't mean a naive change, but some of the ensuing questions, there are things that we can do. You reduce dependence on fossil fuels, try to protect the forest or replant and try to be sustainable. And so it's working together instead of, you know, opposition. Unfortunately, many of us Christians have been dogmatically opposed and saying, you know, this is a left-wing, liberal, tree-hugging, Al Gore-ite plot to try to exploit and transfer wealth. Well, no. There is data. You excellently presented it. But also, you know, what can we do together? Can we do things economically viable to reduce fossil fuel use, maybe use the methane/CO2, like for growing algae for biofuels, or, you know, something that may, yes, it's more expensive than the current gas price, oil price, but let's look at the cost environmentally, and let's do something that will reverse the trends and move us in the right direction.
And the reason I didn't go beyond the concluding slide was I don't want to leave the impression that there's one solution. And that's what's important. I mean, there's lots of potential solutions, from conservation to changing types of energy use to mass transit to, you know, there's lots of potential solutions. And what I think is also important is a lot of those solutions are good to do regardless. Even if there was no climate change, those would be positive, good, sustaining creation care-related actions, regardless, even if climate change wasn't occurring.
There was another question here. Still have it? No? Any other questions? One there.
I had an argument recently with an elder of a church who is a retired geology professor, because I asked him to review my dissertation that is about climate change and birds in the Andes. And he complained that I didn't make some references to the climate change deniers, the guys who said that climate change is not caused by people, that it's a natural event. So, well, I said, well, that's not my point. And my point is just to suggest what the director said, but he said that currently the climate change debate is not good because it's not considering these other options of
the sectors.
So I didn't want to argue more, but what
will
you respond to him?
Well, again, I think the correlation between increase in methane and CO2 with human activity, and we can monitor, we know we can estimate and calculate how much CO2 our human activities are generating, or how much methane human-related activities are generating. So it isn't a question of whether human activities are impacting the climate or increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They are. We can measure it.
Yeah.
And there's a direct causal relationship between the concentrations of those gases and global average temperatures. There's lots of complications. There's lots of positive and negative feedbacks and everything. But that general relationship is I would say, unambiguous.
Okay.